Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up everybody to the truth. Wake up everybody to fight for justice and equality and equity. Wake up everybody to understand that their role in humanity is to make a better humanity. Wake up everybody. We welcome you as always to MPH Radio. Today's theme is Wall Street and Slavery Continue. That's right, Wall Street and Slavery Continue. We will have a critical discussion on its history, tied to what's going on today, and we'd like to hear your views and your comments by calling in at 818-337-0016. Also, like always, our gender will entail what's going on in your world. No, your gender will entail giving you something to think about, a message to the community from our brother Alex. We're going to talk a few black mini facts. And more importantly, we're going to share a discussion on Wall Street and slavery. Continue. That's our lineup for today on MPH Radio. And like always, we ask you to get your pen and a piece of paper. We want to first give you something to think about. And what we want you to think about is to think about this concept of freedom. Freedom is something that often talk about, fought about, died over. But people still have a different concept of what it is. So we want to just give you a term of a definition of freedom that may apply to your reality. And that term or definition is, freedom is having the ability and the means to control those necessities for life. Let me repeat that. Freedom is having the ability and the means to control those necessities for life. What do y'all think about that? Think about it. And we now will move on to some MPH Black Mini Facts for the week of September the 5th to the 10th. We'd like to share with you. In 1883, on the 6th of September, J.A. Rogers, African historian, was born. Yes, J.A. Rogers, an African historian, was born on this day, Monday the 6th of September, 1883. On September the 8th, in 1903, in Barkley, Oklahoma, one of the more than 80 African towns established during the Great Migration was established on this day, September the 8th. 1903. In 1976, September the 9th, Mao Zedong, revolutionary founder of the Chinese Communist Party, made a transition in 1976. So those are some of the Black mini facts for this week. And we now will go to our transition to Brother Alex. We bring in Brother Alex, and he can give us a message to the community. Brother Alex, welcome to MPH Radio.
Well, again, I would like to say thank you. I would like to thank these guests today and our commentators for all the facts and opinions today that they will give. I thank you, Mr. Robinson, for giving me an opportunity to express my concerns to the community as we may grow in the knowledge of uncovering our African-American history that has not been taught in the public school system. So for several weeks, I have watched school buses flash their lights and honk their horns as children board them. I have been in many schools this week and heard the laughter and seen the smiles of many children who are happy to be back after 2 years of learning from home. The teachers and staff told me they are optimistic for that this will be a wonderful year for them to learn. Much of the federal and state funding not spent for over 2 years are abundant in many school districts. Our children should benefit from the Build Back Better plans passed by Congress for education. Just standing there in the hallway of a school built before the 1900s, I can appreciate the struggle my ancestors endured so that later generations of children could read and write. This brought tears to my eyes. Africans and many other people were not allowed for hundreds of years to be taught to read and write in the New World. Learning your ABCs could mean your death in the colonies or the U.S. of A. While there were people in many parts of the world who were doctors, lawyers, judges, professors, and rulers, the European Americans chose to keep the kidnapped, enslaved, and free men of color ignorant and in servitude to their so-called owners. A concept of freedom of citizenship was not acknowledged for fear that the African may revolt and want his freedom, as the Constitution and the Bill of Rights declare that all men are free. The efforts to keep the people of African descent on the lowest rung of the education ladder has been encouraged and forced upon the people of color even after congressional amendments and Supreme Court decisions ruled in their favor. The funding for black public or private education is but a trickle to that of the European Americans by Congress and the business community. The funding to build more jails and prisons is greater than the amount for education of the black youth of this country. I once wrote a paper on the illiteracy of black males in prison from the 1700s to the 1900s. And found out that more men were critical thinkers of rights and freedom then than they are now. Africans who were hanged if they learned their ABC gave their lives so that later generations would be granted their freedom by learning to read and write. So learning our ABCs, I loved school as a child, and I couldn't wait until summer vacation was over to return. At school, I learned many things. The most important thing I learned was how to respect others. We are all born different. We have different names. Our skin color is different. Our ability to learn is different. Our attention spans are different. Our likes and dislikes are different. Our goals and dreams are different. These differences are some of the things we learn to respect when we as humans are grouped together to share a learning experience. Learning should be fun and engaging. We should all learn the importance of how to respect. We may not agree or want to support another's view, but we must rise above violence and belittling of one another. Building trust and friendship starts as a child with a teacher who is a mentor and a supporter of an expanded mind. We can accomplish great things when we work together, fail at everything when we are divided. Months after Dr. Martin Luther King was assassinated, my hometown, like many of America, was being torn apart. There were fires and looting. Schools were shut down. And the National Guard was patrolling the streets, and curfews were issued to keep the peace. Many African Americans, the violence to stop. They were in shock and pain that their leader was assassinated in cold blood. Hate and mistrust filled the hearts of many African American citizens who thought this was a direct attack on the civil rights movement. As a young child, I didn't want to attend my school that fall. For the first time in my life, I would be in a class with European Americans who seemed to represent the murderers of Dr. King. How could I sit in the same room with so much anger for someone I did not know? For years, I enjoyed the safety of my own race of people. The teachers, staff, and children all liked me. Now, I was told we had to be nice to these new kids. These same kids that along with their parents had shouted cruel names and spit at us months before as we marched for the integrations of jobs and schools to be equal for all races. No way did I want to sit a whole day with them. My school was old and the book seemed even older. The teachers were great and so helpful. The food served at lunch was the best. Playground that was big and had a baseball field and basketball court. I could play all day on them. This year, though, all of this would change. Prejudiced white teachers, new books, terrible food, suspensions, and less time on the playground were a few changes that came with integration. As I began to deal with these new changes that September, I started to read about Brown versus Board of Education, which caused this change all over America, and the brave African-American children were escorted to school by federal troops. In 1951, a 16-year-old Barbara Rose Johns attended Mouton High School in Farmville, Virginia, which was hardly a school at all compared to its white counterpart across town. Mouton was underfunded, undersupplied, and dilapidated. More than 450 students attended a school built for 180. There was no gym, no cafeteria, and no plumbing. As many as three classes were taught at the same time in the auditorium, while others were held in our old broken-down school buses parked on the side. Barbara Johns inspired a walkout and a grievance for something better than the tar paper shacks referred to as chicken coops. And they were hot in the fall and cold. Mrs. Johns contacted the NAACP, and with other community support, they filed as a case along with Brown versus the Board of Education and won. Mouton High School is now a civil rights museum, which is a forever statement that African Americans lived in an unequal society and just prevailed by the people's determination and the law. In 1957, the Reverend Fred Shuttleworth and his wife Ruby attempted to roll their children and the previously all-white John H. Phillips High in Birmingham, Alabama, and were met by a mob of Klansmen who attacked them. The police were nowhere to be found as they were beaten with chains, baseball bats, and brass knuckles. Ruby was stabbed in the hips and both were bloody. As they finally escaped the melee, Fred drove them to the hospital. One of his assailants that day included Bobby Frank Cherry, who 6 years later was involved in the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing that killed three innocent black girls on September the 15th, 1963. This was a white supremacist terrorist bombing this country must never forget. Fred, Ruby's children, said that they would never forget the horror their parents endured just to enroll them into the local high school. It was an American tragedy of white privilege and racial hate of their fellow citizens. The Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth became one of the outstanding leaders of the civil rights movement. His fearless stance to kill segregation or be killed by it was a well-token motto by many. Again, in 1957, another group of parents and students were confronted and threatened if they set foot in their assigned school. They became famously known as the Little Rock Nine. The governor of Arkansas, Orville Faubus, closed the public schools for a year and stated that violence and bloodshed would come if the schools were integrated. President Eisenhower, following the Supreme Court and amendments to the Constitution, sent federal troops and the National Guard to Little Rock to ensure the safety and rights to be integrated by force. Was humiliated along with other races who stood on the idea that separate but equal was fair to the people of color. In 1962, James H. Meredith, a brilliant student who served in the United States Air Force and had academic success in high school, was denied acceptance into the University of Mississippi because of his race. Governor Ross Barrett declared, "No school will be integrated in Mississippi while I am your governor." Meredith, along with the NAACP and the other civil leaders, asked for the government's help. U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy ordered the U.S. Marshals, the Border Patrol agents, and the Federal Bureau of Prison officers to oversee his arrival and registration. Riots broke out, but they were quelled by the additional U.S. troops President John F. Kennedy sent to the university. 2 years later, Meredith graduated a degree in political science. He later attended Columbia University and earned a law degree in 1968. The University of Mississippi has celebrated the 40th, 50th, and now the 6th anniversaries of his graduation, and a statue of Meredith stands outside in his honor since 2006. In a 2002 interview with CNN, Meredith said of his efforts to integrate Ole Miss, "I was engaged in a war. I considered myself engaged in a war from day one. And my objectives was to force the federal government, the Kennedy administration at that time, into a position where they would have to use the U.S. military to enforce my rights as a citizen to stand at the schoolhouse door in September 1963 by Governor George Wallace was the height of privilege audacity. His symbolic attempt to keep his inaugural pledge of segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever, and to never desegregate the Alabama school system was a ploy to stop the registration of African-American students Vivian Malone and James Hood. His attempt failed as President Kennedy sent federal troops to Alabama to comply with the Supreme Court decision. Yes, as I saw the happy faces of all races, laughing, playing, shouting, and having a good time on the first days of school, I remember this was not so for millions of African-American students less than 50 years ago. The ABCs of life have to be taught responsibly by good teachers who value the true history of this country. Our ancestors gave their lives for us to be educated. We would still be in chains and in bondage and illiterate if not for their sacrifice. And I thank you, family.
We thank you, Brother Alex. The views and comments that you have just heard are those of Alex Shorter and not necessarily the views and ideas of MPH Radio. If you'd like to make any comments or have any questions, feel free to contact us at mphradio@yahoo.com. Thank you, Brother Alex, for your commentary. At this point in time, we're going to take a station break. We're going to play some music with a message, followed by, as Brother Alex stated, learning at ABCs. We're going to play a brief documentary on a segment of the history of King James, the African King. Then we'll be back with our discussion for today's program. This is the voice of MPH Radio.
I know thy works, and tribulation, and poverty, but thou art rich. Welcome to the Black Excellence and Abundance Channel. King James, the first of England, who authorized the translation of the now famous King James Bible, was considered by many to be one of the greatest, if not the greatest, monarchs that England had ever seen. Through his wisdom and determination, he united the warring tribes of Scotland into a unified nation, and then joined in England and Scotland to form the foundation for what is now known as the British Empire. At a time when only the churches of England possessed the Bible in English, King James' desire was that the common people should have the Bible in their native tongue. Thus, in 1603, King James called 54 of history's most learned men together to accomplish this great task. At a time when the leaders of the world wished to keep their subjects in spiritual ignorance, King James offered his subjects the greatest gift that he could give them, their own copy of the Word of the Most High in English. James, who was fluent in Latin, Greek, and French, and schooled in Italian and Spanish, even wrote a tract entitled Counterblast to Tobacco, which was written to help prevent the use of tobacco in England.
King James was a king of Great Britain, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. King James was a black man, and the King James Bible is named after King James the first of England, who lived from June 19, 1566 to March 27, 1625.
The established church was divided during this era. In 1603, King James called a conference in the Hampton Court in an attempt to resolve issues. As a result, a new translation and compilation of approved books of the Bible was commissioned to resolve issues with translations then being used. For example, the Geneva version contained controversial marginal notes that proclaimed the Pope was as an antichrist. The leaders of the church desired a Bible for the people, with scriptural references only for word clarification or cross-references. King James approved 54 scholars to work on the translation, and 47 worked in six groups at three locations for 7 years. Comparing to previous English translations such as the Geneva Bible and text in the original languages. The new translation was published in 1611 and called the Authorized Version because it was authorized to be read in the churches. It later became known as the King James Version. King James was the first to succeed in perfecting the English translation of the Bible. He successfully distributed around the world. King James gathered Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek scholars who were also well-versed in the English language. Many among these scholars were black. Medieval Hebrew had been widely used by the Moors, along with Arabic because a large portion of the Moors were Israelites. The blacks of Scotland had Ethiopian Hebrew ancestry, and they shared the same history of the Hebrew monarchs of Ethiopia. King James himself could trace his ancestry to the tribe of Judah. The name James, meant to supplant, was interchangeable with the name Jacob. In Europe, the letter J was not used until the time of King James, whose team of scholars, who included some of Hebrew extraction, was responsible for its introduction in the English alphabet. Names like Judah and Jesus were pronounced as Yehuda and Jesus, respectively, until the time of King James. This is something that many of our subscribers and viewers of this channel have pointed out in previous videos in the comment section.
The King James translation had a significant influence on the English language and was widely accepted as the standard English Bible. Because of the project being overseen by King James and the care and precise attention to detail during this 7-year translation, the King James Bible was considered one of the most accurate translations in existence. This black king was the first to sit on 3 thrones at once, which was Scotland, England, and Northern Ireland. The King James 1611 Bible also included the Apocrypha. For various reasons, 14 books were subsequently taken out of the 1611 King James Bible. Thankfully, the 1611 King James Version is still available, which includes the Apocrypha. We would also like to point out that the Moors settled in Spain and Southern Europe in 711 CE. Significant numbers of black people found their way to Northern Europe countries such as Scotland, Ireland, France, and Denmark. Since the beginning of the first millennium, the nations of Scotland and Ireland had a significant number of blacks who in Scotland wielded political power as the kings and rulers. This is a little known fact in black history. In 1565, Queen Mary was married by her cousin, a black Scottish man of the royal family, who was called Darnley. Darnley was killed in 1567, but he had left the queen a male heir of her own lineage. Queen Mary's son, James, was born a few months before his father's murder. Thus, he became the first king of England. James VI was therefore the son of a black man and a colored woman. We often hear about black royalty in Africa, but it is a little known fact that there was actually royalty in Europe as well. Yes, folks, King James, the translator of the Bible, was a black man. Let me say, one of the translators of the Bible. As you know, the Bible has been translated many, many times, but the most popular version in use in America for many years has been the King James Version. His actual version was the King James 1611, which included the Apocrypha. The Black Excellence and Abundance Channel, where black history is every day.
Please remember to like, comment, share, and subscribe. And remember, thou art rich.
We'd like to welcome you back to MPH Radio. You just listened to a clipping on the history of Who Was King James. You can get that segment from YouTube. Check out, and we just thought we would play this segment as a good pretext to our discussion today, Wall Street and Slavery Continue, but also to what's going on presently as relates to the transition of Queen Elizabeth II, I believe. And we'd like to have this discussion in the context later on with our theme, Wall Street and Slavery, and try to get a better understanding of how things may transfer from one generation to another and what it means to us as a people today and in the future. So at this point in time, what we want to do first, do a backdrop or have some discussion and fill in our missing page of history of how we felt about the transition of Queen Elizabeth II. We encourage you to call in at 818-337-0016 and give us your narrative of how you view the legacy of so-called Queen Elizabeth II. Right now, we'll bring in Brother Haki. And Brother Haki, welcome to MPH Radio. We'd like to hear your narrative, your version, your understanding of how you view the history and legacy of Queen Elizabeth II. The mic is yours, Brother Haki.
Yeah, I don't know what people really would expect by way in terms of a narrative when it comes to Queen Elizabeth II. I mean, here's a woman who oversaw, you know, the British Empire. In fact, she was conveniently used, you know, as somewhat of a subterfuge, you know, to confuse the African people around the issue of imperialism in Africa by providing a smiling face. But more importantly, though, I think when you look at the history in terms of her family, I mean, her family was extremely racist. In fact, there is a renowned picture of her actually giving a Nazi salute at 7 years of age with her mother, you know, encouraging her to do so. So this notion in terms of, the British Empire somehow being, you know, concerned about the interests of African people is somewhat misplaced. So I think in the context of Queen Elizabeth II, you know, I mean, there's only one thing you can say. And I think that the sister out of Carnegie Mellon University said it well, Professor Uju Enya, I think she said it very, very well. She said she hoped that Queen Elizabeth has an agonizing death, a very excruciating death. Not to be callous or cold, but the bottom line is that, you know, what she represented was nothing short of traumatic for the masses of African people on that continent. And I'm not just talking historically. I'm talking about currently. So clearly, you know, in terms of any kind of a love for Queen Elizabeth II, I have none at all. I mean, I just see her passing as another imperialist passing. So I don't have anything particularly nice to say in terms of, you know, what she was all about. And for me to somehow feign or pretend like somehow that I'm concerned that I'm saddened by passing will be extremely disingenuous on my part, and that I certainly won't do. But I'll simply close with that by saying that, you know, listen, now that she's gone, my position is that's simply one less imperialist in the world, and I close with that.
Thank you, Brother Haki. We now will go to our supporter, Brother Anthony. Give us your take on this narrative of the legacy of Queen Elizabeth II.
Oh, Queen Elizabeth II, as the British royal family in general, is a symbol of state. In other words, she represented British imperial interests. She didn't have any control over what was said. That belonged to the British Prime Minister. But I don't feel any way for her. It's another imperialist gone. However, her son is her successor. So that doesn't mean that the pains of British imperialism have gone away. As a matter of fact, they remained. I don't feel any way because she represented the evils of British imperialism worldwide, and it's brought devastation and suffering to millions of Africans around the world. And that's how Africans should remember her. And some Africans are aware that some of us are confused because some of us think that we're part of European and U.S. controlled culture, which we're not. And that's been made clear throughout history. So I think we need to intensify our struggle to get organized and unite to achieve genuine liberation from all forms of exploitation, which the British royal family represents.
Thank you. Then we go to Moses. Brother Moses, how would you view the legacy of Queen Elizabeth II? Can you hear me, Brother Moses? While we wait for Brother Moses to come online, you will go.
All right, I got it. We find ourselves in a political economy that is historically developed and has a beginning and an end, and right now we're under capitalism, but this feudalism of the British Empire, the remnants of the feudalism remain. And as a Marxist, I'm trying to create a egalitarian society with equity and for everyone. And so I have problems with the exploited system of feudalism and the Queen being the head of the government of that system. We are born into a political economy. I can appreciate that. She was born into a political economy. She had no say into what was going on when she came here, and she entered, and from then on it was up to her to make a decision about what kind of life she would live and who her friends were, who her enemies were, etc. I don't know the details of her life that much. I do know that, existentially, as a monarch, it's a problem. It's a problem. She will be viewed by different historians according to their class analysis. I see nothing reactionary falls of its own accord. It has to be toppled. And so the British, the throne will continue until the people themselves unite and decide that they don't want it. Like I said, nothing reactionary. It has a way, it's like capitalism and all the other systems, feudalism. It can continue to adapt because people are ignorant and people are... have different class interests, and is able to combine with the reactionary corporate interests and preserve itself. I hope that someday we will be beyond feudalism. Thank you.
Thank you, Moses. And we go to Professor Neil Holmes. How should an African view the legacy of Queen Elizabeth II? Professor.
Yeah, I don't think we should look at Queen Elizabeth of England or of the United Kingdom any differently from any other member of a monarchy or so-called royal family, because what we are looking at is a leftover from feudalism, and what this institution does in the UK. In the United Kingdom, it actually ideologically unites three oppressive systems. It unites slavery because the kings and queens of England were some of the greatest slave traders and enslavers in the entire world. The Royal African Trading Society was what they did to go in and take our people from Africa and bring them over here and all other parts of the world, in the Caribbean and in South America as well as North America here. The feudalism, which they do, was based on the brutalization of peasants and serfs, the murder, the taking of their land, and especially the brutalization of the Irish people and the taking of their land and letting them starve, selling their potatoes, doing a potato harvest and letting them starve so they could make more money. So I don't love feudalism anyway in Europe or Africa or wherever, because normally where you see it, you see some small group which is wealthy at the top. That wealth doesn't come from their work. Their wealth comes from the brutal, murderous exploitation of the people who are under them. And the third system that is ideologically presented by the royal family, and the queen being one of them, is capitalism, which today exploits the world inside and outside, making people homeless. We have people in this city who are homeless because the landlords want to kick them out so they can charge higher rent. You have businesses that are making huge profits with these private prisons and having conditions that are unbearable in these prisons. So in the United Kingdom, what this so-called royal family represents is an ideological justification for oppression and brutalization, murder, exploitation, and the rape and ripping off of the masses of the world's people, because the British Empire, the sun never set on it, and its child, its stepchild, is now in the United States, and the sun doesn't sit on it. The thing about capitalist, slave, and feudalist ideologies is they take things and they turn them upside down. So you take a brutal system like feudalism, and you make all of these king and queen stories, the prince kisses the girl and the prince was a frog, she kisses him, and all of a sudden he becomes a prince and everybody lives happily ever after. Or Snow White goes to the ball, she marries a prince, and everybody lives happily ever after. And you've told these stories, so you have the, people wanting to be, this storybook idea of these people who are kings and queens who do all these lovely things, but we don't talk about the bloodthirsty nature, the death, the killing, the murder, the rape, the exploitation, the theft that's involved. So they take all of that ugly stuff and turn it into pretty stories that we tell children, and we grow up believing, even as adults, and while they continue to do these nasty things. At the same time, they take the people that they ripped off, killed, and brutalized, and they call us savages and brutes and whatnot. So it's just an ideological justification for keeping people out of the loop, misinformed, uneducated, and emotionally attached to the same system that's dogging them every day. As Kwame Nkrumah tells us, slavery, feudalism, and capitalism are only modifications of slavery. So if you love feudalism, then you love slavery. If you love capitalism, then you love slavery. And these things, these institutions like these king and queens, you go up to the palace and they got all this stuff they stole from everywhere. And you walk around, they're paying all these people billions of dollars to live in this place, and people are suffering. all around the world, and they don't do it. And like you say, what do they do? They don't do anything other than show up and cut ribbons and all this ceremonial stuff. So it's so as an institution, I don't want to talk about her as an individual, but I want to talk about her as the institution that she represented. Because when we first began to know her publicly, she was in Kenya, which was one of the areas that was colonized by the British and still suffering from that colonization. When everybody, you know, a lot of people are crazy about Diana, but when Diana died, her brother was in South Africa, where the British continues to oppress our people, although they have gotten some formal independence and stuff like that, but they still control those, the gold, the diamonds, and all of that, while the people are suffering with high levels of unemployment. These are institutions that we need to wipe out of our mind ideologically, so we can go ahead and wipe them out in a material form, because they are really getting us confused about the system that is oppressing us.
Thank you, Professor Holm. Brother Alex, you have heard very narratives of how people may view the institution of England and Queen Elizabeth. How would you view it?
Well, Mr. Robinson, after listening to everyone give their comments, and they were great comments, because sometimes we have to take the fantasy away. We have to take the imagination of what could have been if the right thing had been done. And as well before her time, because it started much sooner than her reign. Was she taught to be a queen for the people? And I mean all people, or just some of the people. Take over countries, and countries who not even willing or wanting you to even be there. When you take over cities in the world, as the British have taken over cities like Hong Kong or Singapore or wherever they've established another separate state or colonization of a territory, well, out in the Pacific Ocean, down in the Caribbean, from Jamaica all the way to the African continent. Britain, United Kingdom, England, who may have sat on the throne during that time? We're only thinking about what the good professor just said. They were not thinking about the people themselves, but what they could take from the people. So when you begin to continue to stand for that type of oppression, then you have to actually wonder why that people even celebrate. Especially, I'm sure, not many Africans are celebrating. But we do give our condolence to the family, because someone did die. A lady did die. What she didn't do, what she could have done, would have made a difference in the whole world today. Because though she was just a figurehead, sometimes just watching the goodness of one can turn the minds of millions. Few good spoken words here and there could have changed things in Parliament and gave countries independence even sooner. Trading, removing embargoes that was placed against them, and different things like that, making sure that the other people in the world, since you considered yourself a kingdom and that you were on top of so many different countries, then you should have been a leader in making sure that their goods got completely around the world, since you had so many great navies for so many years, the great English Navy. So through your trade, through your government, through your compassion, you could have done a better deed is what I feel like in life. She will be remembered in the history books, maybe as a great queen. I don't know. But there will be writings about her, regardless what I say or anyone else say. But in my heart, today, no, I'm not moved, because I can't be moved by things that I know could have been better. And I see no evidence, and I research a lot, but I see no evidence of truly where she tried to make a difference. And that's where I like to stop. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex. We will raise this one fundamental question with our participants today on this issue, then we'll move forward. And this is the issue. I'd like to hear each person's response to this issue of, because one is born into a institution, or if one take over an institution, it sort of gives them the liability for the continuations of the acts that they carry out in the name of the institution. In other words, Brother Hackey, should she be relieved from many of the acts that the institution did prior before her? Is that an excuse or looking at her a little more favorable, or not being a evil, bad, oppressive person? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, well, you know, I don't make a distinction between the individual institution. I understand that the institution carries out the policy, and that's pre-established, and that's certainly understood. But what we can't divorce is the actions of that individual impact on the world generally, in the case of Queen Elizabeth II. I think that you're absolutely correct. I think there is a tendency where we say, well, because they work in the context of systems, so therefore, you know, it's not their fault. They're simply doing what they're preordained to do. And so that conveniently allows them to escape, you know, any type of culpability. I think that is fundamentally wrong. I think those people who occupy these institutions, knowing mandated these institutions, certainly in institutions coming to understand what those institutions mean, if they don't take a stand in terms of the fundamental wrongness of the institution, then they carte blanche endorses the mandates of that institution. In that context, they cannot escape culpability. Their complicitous in terms of the process, which is detrimental, destructive to humanity generally, and so therefore they earn no respect in my estimation, or they certainly don't deserve the right in terms of being exonerated, you know, based upon their actions. So it seems to me, you know, that we can ill afford to say, well, because they're part of an institution, then therefore we let it go. Well, if that's the situation, then we don't create the narrative or create the conditions would suggest that if you join these institutions and you carry out the mandate institutions, that somehow that you're going to be exonerated. On the contrary, we want a situation where we say you join those institutions, knowing they mandate the institutions and you carry them out anyway, then you will be vilified or you'll be demonized. You'll be whatever in terms of exposing your real wrongness in terms of the policies that you embrace, you know, in that institution. So I don't make a distinction between the institution and individual. I think Queen Elizabeth was very, very clear in terms of her role as the queen. In fact, when she went to Africa to meet with African leaders, you know, one of the things she didn't do was to give them any inkling in terms of what she really felt. She served the interests of that institution. And it served the interests of the institution. She understood her role was to smile and to pretend like everything is fine and that we got your back. In the back of her mind, of course, she realized that her role was to, you know, make these savages think that, in fact, their policy is of interest, you know, to African people. In reality, she understood that wasn't the goal. So she made a conscious decision. I don't even necessarily say an unconscious. I think it's a conscious decision to say, listen, I'm going to play this role because not only, you know, do I agree with the mandates of this institution, but also because, you know, there's something in it for me in terms of playing this role. So in that context, I don't think we can excuse her behavior simply because she's part of an institution.
Thank you, Brother Hackey. Anthony, your response.
I concur with the points you and Hackey made in terms of Queen Elizabeth's role. She, when she inherited the throne, you know, she had certain options. She chose to opt, you know, for the option that made a lot of money and notoriety for her and her family. And so I believe it's correct that even though she inherited her role, that she should not be exonerated from her responsibility as a human being because of that.
Brother Moses, your response.
Yeah, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. It's as simple as that, and you have to see the problem and then address the problem. And I don't think she thought of the throne as a problem at all. I think she thought all of it as an asset. And so, you know, the prince and his wife who just left the rural succession, I guess. Anyway, they went off to California or whatever. That's a step probably in the right direction. Probably, I think they can do more, but I think they recognize the institution as a problem. You can't separate the individuals from the institution at this point. Thank you.
And Professor Holm, your response.
Yeah, I kind of agree with everyone that, you know, basically, you know, she's part of an institution, a corrupt institution. But as Emil Cabral points out, if you have any level of consciousness, you commit class suicide. And you not just step away from the institution, but you struggle against the institution. In order for that to happen, though, you have to have real intense mass struggle among the people. The struggle is so intense among the people that those questions that you might not ever think about, as somebody who grows up inside of a privileged institution, might never confront. So, you know, when an individual who's born inside of an oppressive community, in those cases where they commit class suicide and join the people, these situations often occur or most likely occur when there is tremendous levels of nation class struggle going on that's going to push them to some kind of consciousness and some kind of making a decision that they have to step away and step against the old system.
Thank you, Professor. And we go to Brother Alex. No response to that issue, Brother Alex.
Well, again, I hate to ring the same bell, but I agree with mostly everything that's been said again. And that's what we have to look at. We look at a young girl that was groomed for a queenship, as we may want to call it. And when you're groomed for something, taught for something, yes, you've told day and night what to do and what not to do and how to protect interests of the state. And so the interests of the state, meaning to smile and shake hands and perpetrate that everything is going fine. And as long as she was doing that, everything was okay. But we have to get beyond that. If you're going to call yourself a true leader or a true monarch or whatever, and she would have had to meet with those prime ministers and with parliament to make significant changes to make sure that everything was all fair in every part of the kingdom and start granting the independent freedoms of each nation so that they could carry on as independent countries. Because you don't take a child and just throw them out to the wild. You have to give them some kind of instruction, some kind of resources or something. And that was one of the things that if we look at the different countries that Britain took over, even Australia and different ones, there was not all this great support that Britain gave them as they gained their independence. So it was one of those big things that if you're the head, people look at you as being the one in control. But I don't think she was ever truly in control because the monarchyship had been destroyed many years before, and that was just a figurehead position. But she chose to stay in that role. And when you stay in a role and you confine yourself only that, and that's what it appears to me that she did for so many years. She just stayed in her lane, as we call it. Stay in your lane. Did not go to the other side. Did not push the envelope. Did not try and rock the boat. That's what we should be concerned about, is where we could have made a change if only she had done certain things that may have been in her power, may not have been in her power, but at least bring it to the test to see if you can truly make people free. America itself founded its own principles of freedom from the English when we got here because we wanted to be finally free of them. So being free, or as a gentleman said before, America's England's stepchild, to be totally free of England, we bequested freedom. How many times and how many nations have asked for freedom from Britain? But again, they were denied. So that's what we have to look at. You know, it's a legacy that will be written by historians, and it's one that I really, truly don't even care to even read because I know of the oppression of the British Empire. So I thank you again.
We'd like to thank everyone on the segment for giving their perspective on the transition of Queen Elizabeth II. What we're going to do right now, we're going to make a transition first by going to a station break with music with a message. And when we come back, we want you to stay put. We're going to have a discussion on Wall Street and slavery. Continue. Then we're going to link what we have been talking about to the present day of Wall Street and the institution of slavery. One of the things I'd like to remind everyone who was listening to this recent discussion is that no one can give you freedom. If they can give it to you, they can do what? They can take it away. You must understand freedom is something that you must take, must come from you. And I think once the masses of our people understand that, we'd be in a better position to go and get it. So this is MPH Radio, the voice of MPH Radio. We will now go to our station break, and when we come back, we'd like to have you discuss with us the issue of Wall Street and slavery. Continue. This is MPH Radio.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Sky.
sick and tired of your ism, kism game. Dine and go to heaven in the Jesus name, Lord. We know and we understand Almighty God is a living man. You can fool some people sometimes, but you can't fool all the people all the time. So now we see the light.
What you
gonna we gonna
do?
Stand up for
yeah,
all right.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You better
get up.
Me no one know the demon. No, me no one know the demon.
Yes, they got us living on the front line. They got us born at the wrong time. Welcome back to MPH Radio. We'll make our transition here on to our theme tonight, which is a recent article, an interesting article that was written several years ago that highlights the history of Wall Street and its relationship to the slave market or slavery. We talk about this because when we talk about this, we must begin to start connecting the points, or the dots, they will say. As you say, we look at the history of the British Empire that we earlier were discussing. We'll first start out even for Africans ruling in that region, transferring to European coming to power, transferring to they going out to the rest of the world, they enslaving the rest of the world in their image and their own interests. Wall Street is a continuation of this European institution that we call the monarch, or that we call capitalism, or that we call imperialism, and have different people play different roles at different points in time historically. As part of Missing Pages of History, we want to raise the consciousness of our people about the history of our people and its relationship to the present reality that we find ourselves in. As an interesting article, you get a chance, you should Google the article title, Wall Street Was a Slave Market Before It Was a Financial Center. Alan Singer. Yes, Wall Street was a slave market before it was a financial center. What is the relationship between Wall Street, slavery, and Western institutions? We can have that discussion at this particular time. We'd like to bring in Brother Alex. You had a chance to look at this article. It raised a lot of really interesting points and issues. There is a continuation of what we see going on today as relates to the world in general and African people in particular. Brother Alex, would you like to share some of the points of interest that you received from this particular article when you read it? The mic is yours.
Yes, I'd like to thank you because, you know, years ago, again, we look at and what I talked about on the last program, having a financial plan for success in this capitalist society. Because to keep up with the Joneses or just to have something for retirement, we have to invest. And the idea of investment when this country was founded was in slaves. They were a commodity. So the young country at that time invested a huge amount of money to bring slaves to this country. So along with everything else that was cargo on ships, there was a thing called human cargo. And those were the slaves from Africa, transported to South America, then brought to America. So not all of them came direct. Let's keep that in mind. But a lot of African Americans were in cargo from South America to North America. So as the envisioning of Wall Street by Alexander Hamilton, he was one of the first thinkers of there should even be a commodity trading. Hamilton also played with the idea, understood how important it was to make African America part of that Wall Street experience. So to know that there was a designated spot, just as there's in Richmond, Virginia, there's in Fayetteville, North Carolina. There's in Charleston, South Carolina. There's in Philadelphia itself. There are markers where slaves stood to be sold. So, yes, Wall Street did have a rock, a platform, a slave market where you were bought and sold. You were rented out. New York was one of the first places that even had a rental or leasing of Negroes. to do the common work in the homes of the wealthy, because that's what you were seen as, servitude, workers, something that could, or someone that could do something for someone else. So when we look at the different banks and groups that came out of this and how much money that they donate to presidential campaigns and different things, I was astonished at how much money that these gentlemen give out. This is just ridiculous. But then that's how we know that the country is being run. Run by what? That top 10 to 1%. All our laws and different things like that, we could debate, we can talk all day, but when it finally comes down to it, a lot of them decides what laws are passed, which is crazy because they have lobbyists in Congress who are well-funded and get their ideas across of what we should make as a living wage, as what we should pay for medicine, as what we should have for retirement, how much we should spend on the interest rate for a mortgage. All these things are controlled from Wall Street. And Wall Street is not thinking about the common man, except for how much he can scam off of him. So that's what we have to look at. It's all about profits and moving on. You know, let the poor fall where they may. We're in it to make it. We're not in it to make sure that somebody else makes it. We're in it to make it ourselves. That's why there are not 300 million investors in Wall Street. Your money's there, but your representation ain't. So that's what we have to look at. And this is just an astonishing article. And I hope and pray that people do check it out, because it is well worth the time of reading. And I'd like to turn this over and hear the other views forward.
Thank you, Alex. You may bring Hakeem and get his perspective on it. But Brother Hakeem, before you say anything, I would like to read one little paragraph from this article I found really interesting in terms of, we said Wall Street and slavery continues. And a young lady, Mary E. Lease, who had her problems with the functioning of Wall Street and the institution of slavery. And she made an analogy or made an assessment during that time that very well can still apply today. I'd like to get your response and just some of your thoughts from this article. She stated that Wall Street owns the country. It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. The great common people of this country are slaves, and monopoly is the master. Our laws are the output of a system which clothes in rows and honesty in rags. Your response to this article, Brother Hackey?
Yeah, well, she's absolutely correct. This notion that America is somehow a democracy is a misnomer, and it's important that people can understand that America is not a democracy. And so when we talk about economic justice in society, we got to be very, very real in terms of even talking about that. Because one of the things, when you talk about economic justice in America, you can't talk about economic justice in America without talking about the social structure in society. One thing that's peculiar to Western nations, in particular America, is that, you know, historically, you know, you always had bureaucracies which were pretty much horizontal in the sense that everybody was on the same level. And so in that context, the access to resources was a concern for all. So those leaders from positions of power recognized that, you know, they had a moral as well as a political obligation to provide for those on a level, simply because we're all on the same level. There's no greater human being or no lesser human being. Well, we fast forward to the West, and we talk about the feudal society, and we talk about a social hierarchy which was totally vertical. So you had a situation where those at the top, whose position was that because we're at the top, we do everything in our interest. And so therefore, when we talk about monetary earnings, then anything we can use to capitalize, anything we can use to monetize, the situation as it exists, we do so simply because it's very, very profitable.
So in that context, you got to understand that when we talk about Wall Street and being in control, that you can talk about a finite, a cobble of individuals who are in control. In conjunction with their political minions, you know, exert absolute control over society. In that context, if you think that the only thing that value matters in life is material gain, then why would you think that the value of human life is important? This is what I think the fundamental philosophical precipice a lot of us struggle with in terms of, you know, how the society is organized. And so we have to understand that to the extent that many of us among rank and file who embrace this notion that material things are finance of human beings, we support that power structure to give them power. And so we fundamentally have an economic system, as the brother talked about. He talked about the setting up interest rates, the setting up monetary policy, the setting up fiscal policy. All that's designed by a cobble of individuals who have no regard whatsoever in terms of the true functioning of the system. In fact, the information that we receive pertaining to economics is often faulty. It's not even real. For instance, you know, when we talk about inflation, people talk about inflation being just simply a reflection of price increases in society. What we don't understand is inflation is actually an invisible tax. Who benefits from that tax? It's the capitalist class. Do they care about this inflation impact of all overall society? Of course not, because that ethos says that the only thing that matters in life is material gain. And so this is a fundamental thing we have to understand. So when we talk about in terms of Wall Street owning America, that's precisely what's going on. I don't know why in the 21st century people are still hard-pressed to understand not only the wealthy, but Wall Street specifically owns the society. In that context, when you talk about the expenditures in terms of, you know, politicians, understand these expenditures exist for a reason. They exist, you know, specifically to control the motivations and views of politicians. Do politicians acquiesce? Of course they do. They go along with it. They understand as long as they play the game, there's money in there for them. In the process, they give more and increasingly more and more power to a small minority of individuals, about 0.1% of the population, who have enormous amount of power in terms of what goes on in society, how society is shaped, and the differential between those who have and those who do not have. So clearly, she's absolutely correct. This country does belong to Wall Street. It's in time that the masses of people can understand that this country does belong to Wall Street. Unless we're willing to fight back, the reality is that nothing's going to change.
Brother Anthony, can you speak a little bit to the relationship between slavery and the creation of Wall Street? Because, Brother Anthony, when we talk about history, we must understand how things came into existence to properly understand it and to understand our role in it. A lot of our people believe Wall Street is the best thing in the world, and not only should we maintain Wall Street, but even increase more activity with Wall Street. What is your response to that? Understand its history and practices as it relates to enslaving African people.
Well, a couple of things I take away from this article, in addition to the points that Brother Haki made, is a lot of the early institutions in New York City were built with slave labor. For example, the first city hall was built with slave labor. And in addition to that, some of the economic terminology that's used, for example, stocks and bonds, come from the chattel slave trade that took place in New York City. In addition to the fact that a lot of the early buildings were built with slave labor, and that slavery was so rampant in New York that one out of every five people in New York City was an enslaved African. Yet, there are no signs or plaques or indicating, the role that enslaved Africans played historically in the development of New York City. Except for the African burial ground located near the Federal Building in downtown Manhattan. But other than that, there's no trace of that of that African presence. And the connection between the slave market and Wall Street today, it, as I indicated earlier, is that a lot of the business terminology, for example, stocks, bonds, market, came from chattel slavery activity that took place in New York. And I want to point out that the statement that Mary Leese made, which applies very well today, was made in 1896. So as early as the 19th century, it was apparent that the U.S. was for Wall Street, by Wall Street, and a government of Wall Street. As early as the 19th century, some people realized that. And that's how far back, this history goes. It's nearly 400-year history.
Thank you. Evan Moses, any thoughts you have on this article you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, the article was interesting. Slavery is cruelty of humans against humans. I understand it was just business, and nothing personal. But that's the same with Queen Elizabeth and Wall Street, etc. It's nothing personal. It's just business, and the fact that you're oppressors and exploiters, I must recognize that and deal with it accordingly. Wall Street has a history of exploitation. The financial institution, the finance capital, is centered in Wall Street, and we're gonna have to dismantle that system sooner or later. I'll leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mills, and we'll bring the Professor Holmes in. Professor Holmes, you heard some of the critique that was in this article, and we really just talked about the history of the institution of Wall Street and how it played a role and continued to play a role on essence really exploiting African people. Based upon what you know of that kind of relation of history, are there any comments that you would like to make?
Yeah, I want to make just a couple of comments. First of all, Wall Street began, I think, as somebody already pointed out, as a market. People call it a slave market, a market in enslaved people, a slave market right there on Wall Street before it became another kind of market. The other thing is that when we look at slavery, it had three pieces that you have to have. You had to have the transportation of people from Africa to the United States or to the Caribbean or wherever, and those boats were mostly coming out of New England. And then you'd have us go down mostly in the South, and we're all over because we were all over. Actually, all of the 13 original colonies had slavery, and so you actually did the production itself. But after you did the production, you had to finance it, and the financing of, let's say, the cotton or the tobacco, you had these guys called factors. They would front the money for the production of the so many bales of cotton and all of that. And a lot of our big corporations had two bases. A lot of our big Wall Street corporations had two bases in slavery. For instance, the first joint stock corporations themselves were either where people put their money together and bought stock were either involved in getting land from Indians, being able to take their land, or kidnap Africans and bring them over to that land, or maybe going in some other place like India. So the first corporations were involved in either enslavement or genocide for other people's land. You know, people put their money together. Next, the big banking and insurance companies that still are around, some of them got their start in insuring because you have so many people coming across. You purchase 500 Africans and let's say 300 die, so you lose your property. You insure them with that thing. So some of these big banks, some of those big insurance companies on Wall Street got started that way. Many of the big banks, the biggest banks in this country, got their start in investing in the trade. And then many of the later corporations, the people they call factors, the people who actually involved in financing the cotton up front and getting it to market, getting it to the point where you get it from the field up into the factory, and who provided the money for all this stuff, they were also became part of the capitalist structure that's part of this country. And even today, we see this slavery continues. Again, like I said earlier, you know, as Kwame Nkrumah says that, you know, he says that feudalism and capitalism are only just modifications to this process of slavery. It becomes bigger and stronger and more industrial. And so today, let's say you have certain areas in New York in the African community, they call them billion-dollar blocks. They call them billion-dollar blocks because they have sent so many Africans into the prisons from those blocks, and each of those, and that represents so much money in the enslavement system because you got to build those things, those prisons, it costs bunches of money. You have to put money in there. You have food programs and all, you know, all people are selling food. You got the high-priced telephone services. All of that kind of stuff is a money-making thing. It's a job. It's a jobs program for the rural and small-town parts of many states. And so it's an investment thing for the private of those prisons. So they refer to some of these areas in New York where you got all these Africans going in and out of the prison as billion-dollar blocks because they're making so much money off of our continued enslavement. And once they get into those places, these same corporations based out of New York, based out of Wall Street, that can't give us a regular job doing when we need a job, all of a sudden they can find jobs for us in the prison where we're working these jobs as slave, essentially slave labor. And that includes everything from booking airplane flights to making clothes most of the desks in every, if you go to any state college, any public schools in most states, the furniture, the desks and all of those things are made in the prisons. And they charge for those desks and things, that furniture, as if they were made by high price high level carpentry labor. So that process of enslavement continues on Wall Street, and it continues even in the ongoing process. I mean, a few years ago, back in 2006, you had this collapse of the housing industry because basically Wall Street was taking loans, getting people to get loans, and bundling up and making them a what they call securitization, making them something that that are just a bunch of bad risk loans, and you put them out there all together, and at some point they're going to fall apart, and they didn't care because they made money from those loans, and when people lost their houses, those same Wall Street companies have come back and they have bought up a lot of single family homes, and now what people used to own, they're now renting. And some, in many instances, people who own the house are now renting from the same people who sold them a bad mortgage, and now they have to pay for that. So this capitalist system is such a treacherous, dog-eat-dog, murderous system that does not care about life, does not care about human beings, only cares about profit. It's still embedded. Slavery is still embedded. The logic of slavery is still embedded in those things. And just one last thing here is that, you know, an aspect of this slavery, I think, is that when you go on social media, when you go on the computer, you go on Google, you go on all these things, and they're all stealing information. They're taking information about you and I, and they're selling it. They're selling our internal thoughts. They're selling our what we do online. They are surveilling us. We're being surveilled all the time in everything that we do. And that surveil system is an aspect of in slavery. And the fact that they're selling aspects of our thought, aspects of our belief, aspects of what we want and desire, things that we might not even know about ourselves. They're selling these things to other capitalists, and we don't get a penny for it. So that's also an aspect of slavery. So this slavery is this enslaved aspect, the slavery aspect of capitalism is deeply embedded in capitalism and continues. And Wall Street is one of the top centers, if not the top center, in the world, because Wall Street deals not just with the United States and Main Street, but Wall Street deals all over the world. Those investments, when you've got people getting paid less than a dollar a day in the Congo, digging up the stuff that's so valuable, that coltan that goes into our computers and cell phones and things like that, or digging up for less than a dollar a day diamonds, and whatnot, people starving and eating once every 3 days, not because they're on some kind of dietary thing, but because that's what they're forced to do, then you have a situation that is basically the enslaved aspect inside of capitalism operating in this modern capitalism, where all the benefits are headed into the West, into the you know, from the global South into, you know, United States, Britain and France, etc.
Thank you, Professor Holmes. Brother Hockey, you know, one thing in terms of looking at this article that came to my attention was that when we talk about this whole creation of currency and creating currency, you know, they use the issue of our bodies, enslavement, as mm-hmm. a form of currency.
Yep.
Can you just speak a little bit to this whole question of this legacy of once they find something that they have been successful in, they say they will never give up? Your response, Brother Hockey.
Yeah, well, you're right. This whole question of currency, you know, is a very deceptive one, because when you think about currency, currency specifically is whatever you say currency is. In that context, when we talk about, you know, the dollar, for instance, you know, the dollar doesn't have any real value in the sense that it's not backed by anything. Of course, we understand back in 71 when Richard Nixon took us off the gold standard, the dollar ceased to be, you know, backed by anything. It's simply fiat currency. So the dollar is, in effect, whatever the U.S. government says it is, and it's backed by the U.S. military. Likewise, when you talk about the situation in Africa, and they say your currency doesn't have any value, it's not that the African people, the African leadership are saying that our currency have no value. This is the Western African leadership imposed upon them, your currency has no value.
So this question in terms of you know, what constitutes currency, you know, is somewhat very, very deceptive. And we got to understand. And because we understand it's very, very deceptive, and because you can call anything a currency, no one can be surprised that the African body was defined as currency. And so when you talk about these relationships in terms of facilitating business trades, in terms of using African bodies for currency, clearly, you know, it speaks in terms of what it means to have power in society. So you have these very powerful people, you know, who unilaterally decide for themselves, we're going to decide currency is based upon a human body. Of course, logically speaking, you know, when you think about it, you say, well, how the hell could anybody's body, a human body, be a currency, assuming that it's a currency, something that is created? So clearly, you know, the power of these individuals in terms of defining, you know, what constitutes currency is very, very real. I think also, let me just backtrack one other thing. I think it's important that we clarify. I think, you know, one of the things in terms of, and Brother Neil talked about that, alluded to that, was when we talk about a collateralized debt obligation, and you talk about in terms of, you know, they create these so-called instruments. They call them tranches. And in other words, what they're doing is that they gather all this information in terms of mortgages, mix it all together, then they sell that. Well, they knew first and foremost, they knew in the process of doing that, by doing that, what it does, the arbitrage is going to push up your mortgage rate on a monthly basis. So people who are on a non-fixed rate mortgage will end up paying more each month. They know it was unsustainable. They know damn well that people would not be able to sustain those payments, you know, given the fact that wages are continuing to falling. They knew that people wouldn't be able to sustain, you know, those monthly increases in terms of their mortgages. They knew that. But the question becomes, what is the value of people's lives, you know, that were subjected to collateralized debt obligations? Those people's lives, in the minds of the very, very powerful people who created those instruments, they understand fully well, you know, the implications, or they understand the outcome in terms of what they're doing, but they understood also, at least they felt, that the impact on those people's lives, in particular African people and poor people, they knew the value of their lives is not important. And so, therefore, in that context, when you talk about a currency, they're saying that, listen, we can use these people as a kind of de facto currency. They're going to bring us wealth. We're going to use them by arbitrarily, you know, creating a system, you know, which we know is fundamentally bankrupt, but we can do it because we're going to make tons and tons of money. And so when they look at African people and see African people as a kind of currency to be used, then we understand the depth to which they will go in terms of, you know, utilizing this very vague language in terms of what constitutes a currency for the purpose of profiting them for themselves. So clearly, brother, I think that one of the things we have to keep in mind when we talk about this question in terms of currency, we got to be very, very careful in terms of what we mean by that. Because oftentimes we think currency means a particular thing, but in reality, in terms of how the capitalists use the word currency, is a totally different thing. And so I think that this is something we fundamentally have to be aware of and understand that because this fluid definition of currency exists among in capitalist minds, that we understand that the way in which they can capitalize off pain, the methodology they employ in terms of capitalizing over pain grows leaps and bounds. And so we got to be very concerned about that.
And our last comment on this particular article, Wall Street was a slave market before it was a financial center, by Alan Singer. We go to Alex. Alex, I just would like to get your response to this question of understanding that Wall Street seems to have brought all of the politicians. The politicians are enslaved to Wall Street. They have the money. How can the vote overcome the money question? Alex, your thoughts.
Okay, again, I would like to thank, you know, everyone for their response, because, you know, that's how we learn. I'm getting education here. So I hope other listeners and are reaching out and really expanding their mind, because we're talking about something that is extremely important today, because we're talking about your finances. And again, when we're talking about mortgage rates, when we're talking about what you make as a payday, how it does not compare to what the daily rate is being as far as the market expense is, because that's the rising of your gas prices, the rising of your food prices, the rising of your rent. This is all calculated on how much that they can take from you, how much you can suffer before they can call off the dogs if we notice that the gas prices have gone down. They call off the dogs. So out of the blue, you can spend $1.10 for a loaf of bread, and next week is $5.80. Out of the blue. How could something rise that quickly? We go to Wall Street. We look at stocks. We look at bonds. We look at investments. Who is it hurting to go out here and make these purchases, to buy these houses, to finance these cars? Who is it now hurting with these high interest rates? Do you think your politician is truly caring about you when they're getting thousands, when they're getting millions of dollars from PACs, government agencies, different ones that want to keep everything out of sight? No, it won't be revealed to you. We won't find it in no boxes in somebody's home and somebody's locked away in their basement or whatever. We're not going to find all the clues to what's going on. We can search everywhere. Way back when Wall Street was even visualized, because it was made to make sure that the poor stayed poor, that the rich stayed wealthy in this country. No, we weren't set up with a king and a queen. No, we had greater aspirations than that. Wall Street also spurned that idea of how Congress should conduct itself, how our president should conduct himself in times when the nation would cry out in pain and say, we can't take this anymore. You must do something for us. And we cried about taxation without representation with the British. But we have been 10 times over, not thought about as far as the public is concerned. And Congress continues to do as they please. We can write our congressmen all day long. We can go out, we can protest, we can march, we can do whatever. But again, it's Wall Street. It's the people that control the money, always control the money, who want to control the money forever and not share, because that's not part of a capitalist society, to share with the people that need it the most. It's to keep it at the top where they feel that they know what to do with it instead of you, that you have no idea or no right to know that your interest rates are too high. But because you need somewhere to live, you desire a home, that you will almost pay anything for it. I remember when cars, brand new, were well less than $5,000 a month. And now when I go to the dealership, I can see them over $100,000 a month. $100,000 each. So when you see things that have skyrocketed like that in just a few years, this is ridiculous. This is totally ridiculous. Nothing could get that high in such a short span of time that run Wall Street, have all the information on us. Yes, they sell it back and forth, and they use it. They use it against us. They don't use it for us. They use it against us, because to them, we only mean profit. That's it, profit. That's all you see is profit. Nobody wants to invest into falling stock. Nobody wants their bonds to be worthless tomorrow. No, they only want to continue what they've been doing for years. And these investments, as the gentleman said, for the insurance companies, for the banks, for the automobile dealers, and for the gas companies, anybody that's out there, they know your pain. They know it. These CEOs, they sit by there, they know your pain. But again, the institution that's behind them cares very little for you, those stockholders, those owners. They care very little for you. and in their caring very little for you, they just move on. We can complain all we want to, but there's nothing almost we can do. But I do believe that we will get some honest congressmen. If we continue to vote, we will get some honest congressmen. They may not can change it overnight. It's going to take a long time. This country wasn't founded in 5 or 10 years. It's been 400 years. Things are at a standstill today. They're not so much better than they were before. In a lot of instances, things are even worse. So this is a process that has to be taken by the American people to move forward. Because if we don't move it, nobody else will. No one will care about nothing but you. And your voice needs to be heard. So again, I say, go out. Do your research on your congressman to make sure that the things like interest rates are in your favor. Education is in your favor. Health care is in your favor. Social Security is in your favor. There are so many things that need to be in our favor and not in Wall Street's favor. So we need to change things around. And I look for your support to do so. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Alice. This is MPH Radio. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a station break with music with a message. And when we come back, we have some important announcements from the African Awareness Association by Brother Aki and the All African Peoples Revolutionary Party GC by Brother Anthony. And Professor Holmes has some information on upcoming activities he would like to share. He will be given the opportunity, followed by a special message from our sister, Minister Mary Hunt, as she give a tribute memory to our co-founder, our beloved host and co-producer, Brother Emmanuel Joyner, which we did a tribute to him today's program. So those are the remaining items on our agenda today. Don't go nowhere. You're listening to Missing Pages of History. We'll be right back.
Choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? How long have you hated your white teacher? Who told you you loved your black preacher? Do you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? People must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation
would make a better society. Now some of us would rather cuss and make a fuss than to bring about a little trust. But we shall overcome, I believe, someday, if you'll only listen to what I have to say.
And how long have you had your white teacher?
Who told you you love your black preacher? Can you respect your brother's woman friend and share with black folks not of kin? I say now people must prove to the people
a better day is coming
for you and for me. With just a little bit more education
and love for our nation,
we'll make a better society. And if you had a choice
of colors. Which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right? And if you had a choice of colors, which one would you choose, my brothers? If there was no day or night, which would you prefer to be right?
That's the billion-dollar question. If you had a choice of color, which one would you choose? You're listening to MPH Radio, the voice of MPH Radio. We speaking you straight to the point. We're going straight to the point as we speak to, as we seek to speak to the powerful and the powerless. Right now, we have a couple announcements, and after announcements, and a special statement by Minister Murray Hunt, we will ask our participants to make their final closing thoughts for today's program. Right now, we know that on January the 23rd to the 30th, 2023, opening up the new year, there's a special relationship and a joint effort by MPH Radio and Honor Emmanuel Joyner and the African Awareness Association. They'll be taking a feed and ride trip to Cuba, and one of the things that was on Brother Joyner bucket list was to help our people go and see Cuba, go to Cuba. And we are able to partner this year coming up again, January 23rd to 30th. We asking all our friends, supporters of MPH Radio and family members of Emmanuel Joyner to come and join Africa Wellness Tour to Cuba. The question we all want to know from the African Wellness Association, Brother Haki, why is this important for Africans to go to Cuba? How does it fit into our equation of missing pages of history? Brother Haki, the mic is yours.
Yeah, well, I think the trip to Cuba is important. One thing I think in terms of struggle, oftentimes we have difficulty appreciating the benefits of struggle, and we tend to see struggle in mundane kinds of terms. I think when you go to Cuba, you get a much broader understanding in terms of significance, in terms of movement. When you look at the Cuban society in terms of how it's organized, and you look in terms of the educational achievement in Cuba, the literacy rate in Cuba, the amount of scientists, doctors in Cuba, and contributing to great things around the world, then you'll get a sense in terms of possibilities. One of the things in the context of America, unfortunately, we're caught up in a system which, from a psychological perspective, tends to reinforce the very negative things in terms of how we think, how we see the world, how we see ourselves. And as a consequence, it sort of negates our ability in terms of actually being self-determined. So I think Cuba gives us a spirit in terms of what it is to be self-determined, or the struggle for self-determination, or to self-actualize as a human being. So I think in going to Cuba and actually talking to Cuban people and talking to people in the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution, which is community organizations geared toward dealing with issues pertinent to the community, when you talk to people like this, these organizations, and you get a sense in terms of what you can do, what is capable, what is possible. So I think that it's very important that we go to Cuba, talk to people firsthand, to see for themselves in terms of, the things that Cuba is doing that are great for humanity. Also, I think just in terms of examples, I think when we talk about the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution and we talk about organizing the community, then clearly we understand that in the context of America, given the overall decline, economic decline of society, that we understand that the reality is that the situation for our people fought with not only a lot of uncertainty, but certainly the potential for a lot of death and destruction. So we have to have strong communities in terms of combating the potential for, unfeathered violence, in the society. Cuba offers an example in terms of how to organize, how to go about building that community, which is capable, of not only resolving the issues that it's confronted with, but actually to be in a position to rebuff situations where the far right
implement violence, you know, direct violence against the African community. So clearly going to Cuba, I think, is very, very educational. I think it'll be an eye-opener. I think we'll begin to fundamentally understand why Cuba is such a threat to the United States government, even though Cuba never did a thing to the United States government, but certainly America has done a tremendous amount to the Cuban government. But despite that, the Cuban people are still loving people, and they love American people. They don't have a problem in terms of American people. They have a problem with what the government does. But they understand they're philosophically and politically sophisticated enough to understand that the American government does not speak for the masses of the American people. In that context, you know, they understand that, and you can attribute that to a political system in Cuba, or educational system, that properly prepares people in terms of not only understanding their mission there in Cuba, but also their mission throughout the world. So this fundamental understanding in terms of what's going on in the world is quite important in terms of what it is to be a Cuban. So I encourage people to go to Cuba firsthand and see for themselves the brilliance, or what that which we call Cuba, because it's such a beautiful place. The people are very, very beautiful. They're very, very enlightened. And the ability to work together irrespective of skin color. You got to credit the Cuban government with doing tremendous things, because we know historically Cuba was infested with a tremendous amount of racism. That racism today is considerably less. Most of the racist Cubans are now in Miami, Florida. So clearly we understand that Cuba has done a lot in terms of, you know, addressing this issue of racism, but also has intimately did a lot in terms of addressing the African continent, particularly the southern part of Africa, in terms of liberation struggles for humanity and justice, you know, in that part of the world. So clearly we owe it to Cuba to visit firsthand for ourselves, to see what it is Cuba has to offer, and to learn and to ask questions. And I'm sure that you'll leave Cuba with a newfound understanding in terms of, you know, the importance of struggle and why struggle has to be waged here in North America.
Thank you, Haki. Next we'll go to Brother Anthony with the African Peoples Revolutionary Party GC, who will be hosting a Nkrumah Day, September 18, 12 noon. Brother Anthony, will you share with our listening audience more information on what is Nkrumah Day and how they can participate?
Sure, certainly. The All African People's Revolutionary Party GC is organizing our annual Kwame Nkrumah Day commemoration Sunday, September 18th, 2022 at 12 p.m. Eastern Time to honor the first Prime Minister of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah. And also, he also participated in FIFPAC, out of which the current definition of Pan-Africanism emerged, and that is the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. Our theme this year is Pan-Africanism must be the primary objective of African revolutionaries worldwide. And let's see, and we will have a discussion about what is Pan-Africanism and what does that mean when one claims to be a Pan-Africanist. So please join us. Let's see. Admission is free. And you can find out more about Kwame Nkrumah Day by visiting our website, www.a-aprp-gc.org, for more information.
Thank you, Brother Anthony, and we will bring in Brother Professor Neil Holmes. We know he is often active doing positive activities and program community. We would like to give him an opportunity for anything that he'll be participating in and doing that it would be good for the public to know and how they can support it. Brother Neil?
And thank you very much. The Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party is also doing what we call an Nkrumah Conference. And it's going to be in October. I don't have the exact date. It's going to be coming out of Chicago. And you can also go on our website, Pan-African Socialist, Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party .org. Pan-African Revolutionary Socialist Party .org. And you can find it. It won't be up. The information won't be up for another week or so, but it will be in October. And also, we do our monthly podcast. Will be airing on the 17th, and you can also get that information at that same website.
Thank you, Brother Neil. And at this point in time, we will turn the mic over to Minister Mary Hunt. She'd like to make a statement as it relates to her brother and one of our co-founders, MPH Radio, Mrs. Joyner. We call her Mr. J. And we are happy to be able to hear her voice because I know she's going through some difficult times. And we are with her. And Sister Mary, it's always a delight to hear your voice. We give you a few minutes to make a statement in reference to your brother, Sister Murray.
All right. Same here, Mr. Lee, and thank you so much. I've enjoyed everything that I've heard today. It's been very intellectual for me, and I've learned a lot also. So thank you. I missed last week, guys. I really wanted to talk about my brother, Emmanuel, Danny, Dan. We called him in Mr. J, but I was a little bit under the weather. I'm battling breast cancer for a second time. So thank you all for your prayers, your love, and your concern. My big brother, to some he was called by his wife, Rita, Mr. J, and Danny. By mom and dad, he was called Dan. By our siblings, he was called Dan. By his friends, he was called Danny, J, and Mr. Joyner. His name was actually Emmanuel Daniel Joyner. Mr. Intellectual, a thinker outside the box. He was preordained to love. Also, that was taught by our mom and dad. He was preordained to make people laugh and to turn your frown into a smile or even laughter. He was preordained to have positive energy, that when he walked into a room, everyone smiled, everyone laughed. Here comes Mr. J. He was preordained to learn something new every day, and he loved school. I can remember looking at his yearbook, and he had to be about in the seventh or eighth grade, and it was a group picture. And he was just laughing at the picture. There was no smile. There was a laugh. And I said to him, it was before he passed away, too, maybe about a year or two before he passed. And I said, Daddy, you're just laughing in this picture? What's up with this? He said, I'm just so happy to be here. I'm learning something new every day. That's the type of man that he was. And he shared that knowledge with others. So he was our big brother. In regards to, I was going to read from Isaiah, the NIV version, chapter 43, but God, the Holy Spirit, took me into a different direction. And I believe this is also because of the Queen. So I'm still going to honor the Queen. Like my brother said, a life was taken. The 23rd Psalm, which is a well-known scripture. But again, I'm reading it from the NIV version. The Lord is my shepherd. I lack nothing. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the quiet waters. He refreshes my soul. He guides me along the right path for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely your goodness and love will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Remember, our strength and our courage cannot overcome death in terms of this life, has the final words. Only one person can walk with us through death, dark valley days, and bring us safely to the other side. That person is God, the God of life, our shepherd, our protector, our friend. Because life is uncertain, we should follow the shepherd who offers us eternal comfort and light in the darkness. Amen and amen. I thank you, Mr. Lee, for having me today. And again, I have enjoyed each and every listener on the show. Thank you, Brother Ellick.
Thank you, Minister Hunt. And like always, keep fighting the good fight. We're behind you, and we're going to win. And don't you forget that. We're going to win.
Thank
you,
Mr. Lee. I've enjoyed everything. Again, thank you for having me. It's been very enlightening. Thank you for everything, every prayer that's gone up, every amen that's gone up, and every praise that's gone up, and every worship that's gone up. Thank you.
Okay, sister, you take care. Thank you. All right, this point in time on M-Page Radio, we're going to close out this program. We're going to get each person, we're going to actually take a minute or so, and just give us your final thoughts for the day. Our theme of this program was Wall Street and Slavery Continues. Again, we encourage everybody who have not seen this article to go and Google it. Wall Street was a slave market before it was a financial center. It has so many lessons to learn, so we can better understand not only the past, but also have a better understanding of the present, so we'll be in a better position to make a better future. Please do that and help us to continue filling our missing pages of history by joining us every other Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, U.S. So right now, let's close out our program, which is on the 10th day of September 2022, by asking our brother Moses what his final thoughts. Any thoughts, Brother Moses?
Thank you, Brother Africa. I enjoyed the show. It has been very enlightening. It's always good to hear from Brother Alex and his analysis. And I thank you for his sister today. And we enjoyed the show, and I'll just leave it right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Moses. 1 minute statement, closing thoughts from Professor Holmes. Brother Holmes, your final thoughts.
Yeah, I also enjoyed the show very much. I think it was very informative. And I would like to say one thing before I go. There was a brother who just transitioned out of Chicago, Brother Ben Alexander. Longtime member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party. If anybody ever knew him, you knew he was a very beautiful brother. And he's left this plane, and we're going to miss him. He's touched a lot of folks. So if you know him, please remember him.
All right. Thank you, Brother Holmes, Professor Holmes, and Nick. We can go to final thoughts with Brother Haki. Your final thoughts for today, Brother Haki.
You know, echo my Brother Moses' sentiments. I really appreciate the discourse today. I think a lot was learned today in terms of discourse, and I simply want to say, you know, we should do this more often, and I'll close with that.
Thank you, Brother Haki, from Brother Haki. We will now go to Brother Yes, who we have left? Here we have my brother, Anthony. Your final thoughts for today.
Yes. My condolences to brother Alexander. I had a chance to meet him in Chicago many years ago. My condolences to him and his family. And also, I would urge all Africans to join an organization that is working for our people's liberation. And also to study our history very carefully and share your knowledge with your fellow brothers and sisters. Because we need organization and political education more than ever now, given the problems we're facing worldwide.
Thank you, Brother Anthony and Brother Alex. We'd like to have your final thoughts for today's program. The mic is yours.
Well, Mr. Robinson, and I'd like to thank each gentleman today, because you contribute to something that we need in our community. And we need an uplift of brothers. We need an uplift of sisters. We need an uplifting of youth, because that's how we uplift our race, is to make things better for us all. If the knowledge was just with a few, then the race would suffer. Because most of the time, as with wealth of anything, and especially wealth of knowledge, it would be with the ones who would use it for their own accord. So thank you for spreading this wealth to the listening audience today, because that's what we need to do, is spread our knowledge in the community. And like Anthony said, to organize. Join some type of party or organization. Join something. But be part of something. Because as we be part of something, we can change things. So I want to also thank for all the condolences for my brother, my sister, for the great reading. And to remember also, I had another brother's birthday today. Armstead has also passed away. So that's been terribly on my mind today. But I thank you all. Because you carried me through another show and you didn't even know it. But you put me on your shoulders and you carried me. And so I thank you for being there, brothers, and understanding that we have a long way to go. This is the beginning of the struggle. This isn't the ending, because this struggle is in our time. And when we cease to exist, we need to pass the baton of knowledge on to the next generation. We can't carry this knowledge into the grave with us. We need to carry it forward to the next generation so we can continue as a great people were intended. And I'd like to thank you, Mr. Robinson, again, for giving us missing pages of history, because without it, today I would feel lost. So I thank you so much.
And we thank you, Alex. No prayers and condolences goes out to being Alexander families, your families, all families who may have lost a loved one recently or during this time. Every other Saturday, we'd like to invite you to join us. Our next program will be on the 24th, 2 weeks from now, 1 p.m. Please spread the word. We also have open membership. If you'd like to become a friend and supporter of MPH, Radio, you can do that by emailing us at mphradio@yahoo.com, and we can share with you how to become an active member. We need you. There are many things we want to improve upon and work on and build in our communities, and we cannot do that without you. So if you'd like to become a member, friend, and support us, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com, and we will respond back to you in a timely fashion. Like always, We must fill in our missing pages of history, because if we don't, who will? This has been another segment of MPH Radio, Wall Street and Slavery Continues. Let's fill in our pages so we can stop this continuation of enslavement, not only by our people, but we want to stop it from being imposed on any people. We want a free and just humanity. And we can do that simply by learning and understanding our history and the history of the world, what role we play in it, and how we can change it. Until next time, this has been MPH Radio, and we want to remind you that we are here for all of us. We'll see you on the 24th. Thank you for allowing us to come to your homes this evening.
We are here.